Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at socialflightlive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. As you can tell from that introduction, we have a fascinating show for you this evening. Greg Bowles from Joby Aviation is here. We're going to talk about his aviation story, urban air mobility, and the future of electric flight. Before we get started, just a few things. As winter recedes, the time has changed, and we are moving into spring. Things are absolutely booming in aviation and in social flight. We have tens of thousands of aviation events and destinations. Just check it all out on socialflight.com and the free mobile apps for Apple and Android devices. We even have all these destinations and a personalized aviation adventure planner called our Destination Digest that you get when you do that as well. And in addition to that, for everyone out there who wants to get wings credits or is an aviation maintenance technician, or if you happen to be an AMP with an inspection authorization, there is still time for you to complete all of that and get all those credits there through Social Flight's FAA Learning Center. We have credited courses that are available. All you have to do is go to socialflight.com or the mobile app, click on the FAA credit section. All the courses are there. It's all completely free, made possible by all the companies here over my shoulder that support Social Flight, make all this available to you. And in addition, we have our Fly to Win Challenge. Our Fly to Win Challenge is where you can go and check in anywhere at a local airport. You get points for everywhere that you check in, every airport, and that makes it possible for you to, even with one check-in, enter into a drawing to win. And if you enter into multiple times, you get a whole bunch of check-ins, you get on our leaderboard, well, then you can get multiple entries into our challenge. We just gave away a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset, and we're giving away another one on April 1st. We're always giving away things here at Social Flight. So all you need to do, again, get that mobile app, check in, and you are entered in to win. It's all in the challenge section. You can see there in Social Flight. Tonight's broadcast is brought to you by Aspen Avionics and the Evolution Pro Max primary and multifunction displays. We fly behind an Evolution 2000 system that's two tubes in our A36 Bonanza, and also have one that's going in that Mustang that you see getting built right over my shoulder. It's got a beautiful panel with that that includes synthetic vision, traffic, all sorts of cool things. Terrain, you name it, it's all in the Aspen. What you may not know about those units is that they also have the optional ability to display angle of attack information. And back in December of 2024, the FAA issued a special airworthiness information bulletin, an SAIB, recommending that all general aviation aircraft get angle of attack indicators installed. And so if you're considering this, if you already have an Aspen, or if you're even looking for to upgrade your panel, that is all possible thanks to Aspen. And again, thank them so much for supporting Social Flight. Now, There is a lot of talk about electric aircraft and urban air mobility, and that is vehicles that have the potential to revolutionize travel in and out of congested cities, as well as other situations. And in this technology race, backed by Toyota, Joby Aviation is the undisputed leader. I was privileged to spend time with Greg Bowles and my friend Katie Pribble at the 2024 NBAA show, which included a tour of Joby's amazing aircraft. And I am absolutely thrilled that Greg is here with us tonight to talk about all of this. Greg brings nearly two decades of aviation regulation and policy experience to Joby as their head of government policy. He came to Joby from the General Aviation Manufacturers Association, or GAMA, where he championed modern regulatory reforms for all of us, paving the way for a new form of daily air mobility. Prior to GAMA, Greg's experience included aerospace engineering for both Cessna and Sikorsky. He is a fellow of the Royal Aeronautical Society and an accomplished commercial airplane and helicopter pilot with over 1,300 flight hours in a variety of aircraft and helicopters. Please help me welcome to Social Flight Live, Greg Bowles.
Hey, good evening, Jeff. Thank you so much for having me on. I am very excited to talk.
Thank you so much for joining. I know how busy you are. I understand you are over on the other coast working with our friends from the FAA today. And the fact you're taking time out for this is really wonderful. And I just can't wait to dive into this and help people understand this new technology and what's coming.
Yeah, it is. It's fantastic to be able to talk today. Exciting times. I think, you know, we'll have a good conversation, and I think you'll glean from that. We've gone from a time when we were working to kind of create a path to making sure the path was ready for bringing these things through certification into the world. And we are deep towards the last tail of that path now. So excited to share a lot going on.
Let's start with a little background for people to get to know you, because you really do have a fascinating background that brings this experience of both traditional airplanes, helicopters, and then getting involved in the regulatory side. So it seems to be everything, the engineering, the politics, let's say, and regulation making. Tell me a little bit about how you got here.
Yeah, so I guess as a young guy, I was the person that would walk around trying to get his friends to put his arms out and walk like a bird, like, hey, follow me, this is how we walk. But I kind of had my sights set on becoming a pilot pretty early. So by age of 9 or so, I was mowing lawns to earn money, growing up in the Cleveland area, and went and found a local flying club and was able to spend that money on learning to fly at around age 15. Over the years, got an aerospace engineering degree. Interestingly, there's a pinnacle moment there early on in school where I had a professor. I loved my education. I went to Embry-Riddle, great place for lots of aviators to be together. But I had a professor say, hey, so the things that are going to happen in aviation have kind of happened. You guys are in the refining business and you're going to make things better and better, and that'll be your career. You'll probably work on a wing spar, I think is what the statement was. And I was like, whoa, that sounds terrible. This sounds horrible. And I'm just like, I can't get rid of the smile, because that's not our world, right? We are living in this next era of propulsion, like the electric era, and it's pretty exciting times. Anyway, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
It's fascinating to me that that someone would have that perspective. I mean, it is true, of course, that, you know, lots of people throw out that concept that we went from, you know, the Wright brothers to supersonic flight in such a short period of time. And yet since then, it's all been about really just efficiency. But tell me a little bit about why that is starting to change.
Yeah, so you know, if we were in the 1950s and we said, this is the jet age, everybody, it's going to be pretty cool, I think it'd be pretty apparent that jets are fast. And then, you know, the next thing you'd say is jets go high. And you kind of say, like, well, that lets us then, we need to pressurize and change the shape. And there's going to be some differences in the way we control the flight because of the speed and the altitudes. We're going to need hydraulic systems and modern avionics as we move around the world. So that kind of drove a very interesting trajectory into aviation we understand and love. So all of the piston stuff is thriving. The jet world is amazing. And we've got like a third new leg developing here, the electric propulsion piece. And that includes like so many cool tenets. So if you look at electric propulsion, you know, we can control these motors so precisely, we can actually blend them into some of the control. So it's propulsion and control blended together in many cases, which is a little helicopter-like, but instead of doing it mechanically, we can control it electronically, right? We can very quickly rate up and down. We can change the pitch. We can change the tilt of our nacelles on the aircraft. Additionally, you know, at Joby, something that's exciting for us is we turn our propellers really slowly. And so I think people have probably seen on the internet, you know, we're excited about the noise profile because we turn those blades so slowly, but we have a lot of torque. We can paddle a lot of air every pass. And so we push the air we need to push every pass at low RPM. And that lets these aircraft be remarkably quiet. And I warned you, Jeff, like if you get out to see us fly in person, a good portion of the folks that watch us fly, they just quit their jobs at that moment and join Joby because it's like a spiritual moment to watch these very quiet aircraft hover and fly around in front of you.
It is. So amazing. And I certainly want to get to that and how you fly it. I'd like to go back a little bit though to your, I didn't mean to interrupt your story. And that is, you know, you obviously evolved into from just the engineering, but included vertical flight into that and also connection, as I mentioned, with people and regulations. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so my first real job out of school was with the Cessna Aircraft Company, which was kind of acquired by Textron while I was there, and some amazing folks like Jack Pelton at EAA. Like Jack became the head of engineering while I was there, and I had, you know, what an amazing icon, and just so many icons at Cessna. I was fortunate to actually, through that flying club, some of the flight instructors I got to work with were the folks who shaped the original single engine series aircraft. Right, knew the ins and outs. And I swear, while some of them, you know, you wouldn't want to get in a car because it didn't seem safe for them to be driving cars at their age. Somehow, when you get in the plane, like, you know, I'd be flying and struggling in the Wichita heat, and they would put their hands on the controls, and like the turbulence would subside, and everything would be right in the world. And you just think, like, this is the way it should be, right? These are where these folks should be. That was an amazing time in my life, spending time at Cessna, really understanding the heritage, and the right way to engineer products. And then, as you said, I kind of went to Sikorsky, or it was actually Keystone Helicopter that was acquired by Sikorsky, another amazing group of folks. And that was during the introduction of the S-92 and the early STCs of that aircraft, and a lot of S-76 products, and actually a whole range of other really cool helicopters that we did work on. And I learned a lot of respect for the vertical lift world. To be honest, as an engineer, I don't know if I'm smart enough to get my head around some of the aeroelasticity and the vibration controls that they use in helicopters. It is wild when you watch how they dampen some of the vibrations. You know, they dampen in axes that are different than where the vibration's occurring. And somehow through physics, I can't wrap my head around that's happening. So I will like wave the flag in some of that. But to like the core of your question, why do they get in the regulatory space? So midway through that time at Cessna, I started to realize that the regulatory burden to bring any aircraft to market was the same. So, you know, I was saying, like, why aren't there brand new single engine airplanes? Like, why aren't there new light GA airplanes? We kind of are introducing new similar airplanes all the time. And it became apparent that the burden, the regulatory burden to work on those products is the same as the big turboprops or piston or turbine airplanes. And you know, you can offset that big upfront cost of doing a new cert project with a more valuable product. And so that's where the market was headed. And that didn't make sense to me. So the idea that why should it be as hard to certify a simple little single engine as it is a jet? Like, that's kind of odd. So I kind of honed my skills into this world of Part 23 rules. So those are the certification rules for airplanes weighing up to 19,000 pounds with or up to 19 passengers. And in looking at it, once upon a time, its origin was CAR 3, and it evolved into Part 23, and it really was amazing. It was a set of rules fit for purpose. And when it was, we saw booming years, the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s, those rules were amazing. And we saw amazing growth in that space. And then those rules started to become a patchwork. And as more complex aircraft were added, those rules kind of got more complex across the board. And the other piece was that they were very technology specific. So they were written around certain kinds of technology. And if you wanted to do something new, you had to get an exemption from those rules. And exemption process is risky and takes time. And so new companies or even established companies weren't really up for the fight for an exemption unless it was a really substantial product. So crazy, you know, I love a fight. So I was able to begin working at the General Aviation Manufacturers Association under actually Pete Bunce, just retired. Amazing, yes. Amazing friend. And Pete joined just around the same time I did, actually. And other amazing colleagues, Walter DeRozier. I was able to work for Walter in the early days. One of the projects that popped up, FAA said, we want to revitalize or renew. They didn't say revitalize. They said, we want to refresh Part 23. We need to look at it. We haven't looked at it in 20 years. What should we do? And around the room, it was I was one of the few non-FAA folks. And I love the FAA folks. And they, but, you know, FAA folks look at things a certain way. And at the time, the structures person at FAA said, well, we should probably turn up the heat on the structures rules a little bit. That's what we should do. And then the systems person said, like, well, we probably need a little more systems rules, a little more stringency on systems, you know, across the board, everybody's silo. And then I threw my crazy idea out, like, that's not the problem. Like, the problem is we're not introducing new aircraft because we've created this burden that doesn't make sense. And we were able to actually, as everybody kind of evolved, the whole country and the thinking of the FAA, actually we got Congress to get on board too. And something called the 2012 FAA Revitalization Act was published, that it was called SARA, Small Airplane Revitalization Act, sorry, SARA. And that law asked the FAA to put in place these rules that we were talking about at the time. I was fortunate to become the FAA co-chair, so I got to chair this FAA rulemaking and then help on the standards bodies that would create the early technology. And we created this new space that would allow us to certify new technologies in really efficient ways. And the whole goal, like Congress, the president, the FAA jumped on board saying, we want to reinvigorate this segment and bring it alive with new technology that can create safety, that can, you know, the technology coming to the table will open the door on safety in ways that are unbounded. There was a lot of amazing stuff that happened. We were just coming off the heels of glass cockpits at the time. And you know, you can show proof. A really interesting antidote we used was moving maps. So the moving map GPS reduced CFIT accidents tremendously. So controlled flight into terrain accidents were like really common. They were, I think, the third cause of fatal accidents at the time. And cockpits that got moving maps, like that dropped out of the top 10. And it wasn't mandated. And a lot of us carry iPads that have this data, right? Even if you don't retrofit. And so this, it was proof that like new technology put in the hands of pilots, they wanted, like, who wants to have a CFIT? Like, nobody. But the burden of solving that has been too high. So technology can really do some amazing stuff. I think this reinvigorated the crazy side of my mind that said, like, there's a lot that aviation needs to unlock. And so this next era is kind of a bit of what has been borne out. We saw some young companies like Pipistrel and others really starting to play in the electric space. We made sure these rules as they were being created were right size for electric propulsion and VTOL and all of the things even beyond that. So we didn't want to make this mistake of saying like it can be either piston or electric. We just talked about propulsion, right? Propulsion in general to make sure that nobody else had to deal with this issue again in the future.
Yeah.
We kind of made it technology agnostic. And so anyway, those rules are on the book. We saw a whole bunch of new companies kind of get created over the last 10 years. And I've said a lot here, Jeff, but maybe I'll share kind of my exit story here on this segment. I would lay at night thinking about these companies and, you know, I was leading this regulatory segment and I kind of laid at night saying like, well, I can continue doing this. I'm really good at it. I enjoy the work. I enjoy the people. I enjoy the regulators around the world. Or I could do this crazy thing and join one of these startups that was inviting me to join. And, you know, I kind of saw myself as an old man in my 80s or 90s or 100, regretting not doing this crazy thing and jumped at it. And so in joining Joby Aviation, feel like it was a young startup at the time, but it has been the fastest and the longest period of my life at the same time. it's been a pleasure and as stressful as you can imagine.
It just brings a lot of joy to my heart to hear that story. And I'll tell you, I was very, very involved in the industry in creating a lot of the synthetic vision technology when that was coming along. And it was the same as you described it back in the days when I was there with Movie Max stuff, of seeing, putting people in simulators and seeing the safety, seeing all of a sudden how spatial disorientation just evaporated, like all these things. And so it really does speak to me when you talk about the excitement of how new technologies like that can all of a sudden really revolutionize safety, but also the ability of what the industry can do. One of the things I'm really curious about, though, is how, I mean, I've certainly seen from that side the same challenges of when you work with the regulators and you're looking at things, there's such a gut like instinct of like, yeah, because we've been wanting to ratchet up the bar in all these areas. How do you balance that and somehow come back to things that are achievable to demonstrate instead of tests for test's sake almost in some cases that hold back so many companies?
Yeah, and so I think that was like an important moment of work too. Amazing icons at FAA had been around for decades and saw the same things, right? And so, you know, when there became, you know, when the word came up and people started talking more and more, you know, more and more FAA folks said, wow, that is true. Like, that is right. Like, wow, we often can't do these things because of this. And we would love to see these new technologies instead of an aging fleet. We would love to see reinvigoration instead of people kind of dwindling away in aviation. Let's bring these airports back alive. Let's have people, you know, there's a virtuous circle where people spend more time, they get better, it gets safer, and more activity is spent, and it's a very healthy cycle. Or there's the circle that was truly going on at the time, which was like the opposite side. It was less activity, it was fewer pilots, it was aging demographic. And so everyone kind of recognized like we need to get in that virtuous path. Today, I'm very excited about the segment I'm in, the electric segment, and making this come alive. But to be frank, I'm really excited about what it can do across aviation. I love aviation, like probably everyone on the podcast that you're having listened here and watch. I think we all have something slightly divergent in our personalities that we love aviation so much, but we want our friends to come in. We want more people to understand it and be part of it. And so my hope is that as this segment really is attractive to a lot of young folks, and we do see that. We see a lot of really young people excited about this. We see a lot of university programs growing in aviation. I think it acts as a huge benefit across the board, right? It brings the best and the brightest folks into the space. It brings new investment and new excitement. It reinvigorates those airports. It lets more people carry the burden of keeping aviation alive. So I know you'll have more conversations with folks, but I think that's what's really important about this is the segment, just like the Jets did, like the Pistons didn't go away. The Pistons got better and the Jets got better. And hopefully this work like across the board has a benefit as well. That's the big hope, I think.
When we were out at NBAA, there was, of course, the big announcement there that was regulatory in nature. So to help people understand what has now been announced regulation wise and how this new generation of aircraft are going to be certified.
So what you need to do to bring these aircraft into space, like it has always been my opinion that you don't want to kind of try to go around or bypass the regulations. That's a very short-sighted idea. What you want to do is kind of work with the regulators. You want to, if you have a key that doesn't quite fit the right lock, you need to just work to make those two things work, right? And so we have to certify the product in the FAA traditional certification path. We have to stand up like commercial operations that fit in the traditional integrated airspace. And that means we have to have the right equipage and we have to have the right kind of interface with the system, the pilot on board in our case. And then you need to look at the commercial operating rules in the airspace and the air traffic and airport integration as well. So all of those pieces are important. And the announcement you're referring to, the FAA issued a special federal aviation regulation, an SFAR. And that is kind of like the Rosetta Stone for our segment. What it does is it says, if you're this powered lift aircraft, you know, in some cases you should be treated like an airplane. In some cases you should be treated like a helicopter. And in some cases maybe novel in a new way. And so it goes through each of these issues case by case and it describes what you should be doing. So it says, for example, with respect to fuel reserves, it tells us to maintain 20 minutes of fuel reserves in the VFR environment, like you would see in a helicopter. With respect to training, it kind of lays out the training regime for existing airplane pilots or existing helicopter pilots to take a course and transition into this space with the right kind of category and class rating. So that Rosetta Stone was really important. When the FAA put that onto the books, it kind of opened up a new chapter for the US. And now we sit at a point where the kinds of products that we are designing and training pilots for integrate pretty smoothly into the airspace. You kind of said this, today I was watching us do some flight tests down in Marina, California. We're doing that many days of the week. And a little like pilot tip, if you want to go watch electric airplanes fly, if you land at the Marina airport and taxi over and take a seat, you will see it happen right in front of you. So please do. And certainly feel free to come out and sit out in the parking lot. If you don't have a airplane to sit airplane side, you can watch it from the parking lot as well at that airport. And over time, more and more places around the country will be flying more and more. We flew in New York City. We've now flown in Japan. We've flown in Korea. And you'll see many, many other companies around us flying all over the world as well.
So tell me a little bit more about the segment, because I think for a lot of people, you look at this and you say, okay, cities already have a version of this, right? We've got helipads, we've got helicopters. Is this just an issue of cost or noise? What is it that is so different about the future here when you compare it to the present?
Yeah, so the early products that you're seeing with electric aircraft fit a very interesting role. Because electric propulsion can be so reliable and require so little maintenance, anecdotally, our motor has like very few moving parts. There's a bearing, right? We don't have pistons. We don't have exhaust. We don't have so many of the large aspects. Because our motors are so simple, the maintenance costs will go down pretty low comparatively. And maintenance cost is traditionally the highest cost in a helicopter. The second highest cost in a traditional helicopter is typically turbine fuel. We'll be charging with electricity. Additionally, we don't use that much electricity. Batteries are not the best, energy density wise, not as good as jet fuel. So we have to design our aircraft to be extremely aerodynamically efficient, extremely energy efficient. And as a result, we don't even use that much electricity on a flight, right? And so our energy cost is really small for those flights. So our third cost is the pilot cost. And that happens to be like that becomes our highest cost, right? Our number one cost is the traditional third cost of a helicopter. Now, if we can bring more folks in because the running cost, the operating cost is low, that's interesting. You start to turn that virtuous circle that I was referring to earlier. You bring in more people, the more people that are in the seats more often, it's even more virtuous, and that's important. One of the next features of electric is the noise. And so we touched on that a little. These super torquey motors that push a lot of air at low RPM let that noise be really quiet. And so as more people want to ride, they're going to say, well, I'd like, you know, instead of having to go 20 minutes to the local airport or local heliport, I sure would like to have one of these near me. And so because they're so quiet, we think that communities and groups will get together and say, let's build a new piece of infrastructure for these things nearby, a new aviation, like let's grow aviation infrastructure in this country and use it for more transportation. That's that same virtuous circle. Working with the MBAs and the VAIs and the AOPAs of the world, they fight so hard to help keep the airports and the heliports open. We're coming to a point in time in this country where people are going to want more of it. And that's exciting too.
That's a really interesting point because, there's those other two areas that come to mind about, feasibility and how to make this really expand the way people have talked about. And that is infrastructure, both on the ground and also in terms of air traffic or capacity in that regard. So the term, right, urban air mobility implies that the biggest benefit is in urban settings. Tell me a little bit about what you see as I don't know what kind of use heliports have if they're already maxed at these big, you know, metropolitan areas, but how is that likely to go?
So what we're seeing is today, most of the capacity limits are based on noise around that infrastructure. So if you look at New York City, for example, they have a great system of heliports and helipads that are highly utilized, but most of them are capped based on noise exposure to the population around them. And so when you can introduce aircraft that are truly remarkably quiet, that changes the game. You can start to add operations without adding in a measurable way to that noise accumulation. And I think what you'll see is two things. One, you'll be able to do more at heliports and airports. I think you'll see people get excited because the value equation changes. So you know, you have to think of this stuff like a value equation. So what is the upside? What's the downside? So you know, the community has to endure noise, and today they're not participating in it. They say no. If the community is using that service, there's an upside. And if it's not so loud, if it's quiet, and if it's convenient and cost effective, wow, let's do it and let's get going. And I think that can be brought into all of aviation, right? So it starts with a spark of like a little bit of innovation and the segment we're talking about, but I think it rolls into the broader aviation context as well, where people become a little more air-minded, they get excited about it, and they probably start to take helicopter flights in ways they haven't before. They probably start to do airplane charters and do a little bit of the East Coast island hopping in the summer that they may not have considered before. And maybe they go get their pilot license and jump into it the way we hope they all do. That's like the path that you know, people are probably headed towards. There's, so this is, you know,
very much targeting much more of a mass population than helicopters to target today or things like that. You're really, really looking at hitting a much wider audience so that you can generate that goodwill and that positive feedback cycle of we want more of this, we want more of these ports, not less.
You know, the core product that we're offering here to folks is very low friction travel. And so what that means is you open the app, either the Joby app or our partner Uber, the Uber app, and you say, I'd like to fly from JFK to a Manhattan heliport. And maybe you're actually with our partner Delta. And you're planning to do a Delta flight, so you want to kind of leave one of the local heliports and go into JFK, and so you'll kind of hail the ride. An Uber car will get you at your house, integrated through the app. You'll get off of that car at the heliport. The aircraft will be there waiting, like right when you're there. Time to work out well. The other folks who might be in that airplane with you, that little Joby aircraft with you, will be arriving around the same time. Very, you know, we don't want you to wait more than a minute or two. And then the flight will kind of go off 7 minutes into JFK from Manhattan. And we're going to try to get you right to the gate by Delta, right? So that you can very quickly get through security onto your flight in a seamless and efficient way. That's the experience that really changes life. That's like the North Star. I think everybody would expect it'll be work to wiggle into that space, but that's the experience we're all really working hard to create for society. And I think when you look at the cost, we're going to do that at around the cost of an Uber Black on a per mile basis, right? And wow. So that is the big unlock you're alluding to. When you can say, I can sit in Manhattan traffic for an hour and a half in the Uber Black, or I can do this in 7 minutes at around the same price. Our belief is that we'll be capacity limited in the early days, like production limited. And over time, people are going to say, like, well, I learned to do this on the airport run. That was amazing. And now I can, if I'm on the East Coast, you know, in the DC area, I can go from maybe like Easton Airport out to the ocean for the afternoon and visit Ocean City or Cape May for, you know, for the day and at the cost of an Uber Black. It's going to change the way people spend their time and the way people where people live, you know, over time. Along this line of thinking, I spent a lot of time looking at how transportation tools and technology has affected us over the decades. One of those things that's interesting is there's a gentleman named Marchetti And there's something called the Mercetti constant, and it's a transportation measurement. And what it says is that humans, we like to migrate about 30 minutes away from our home in the morning and spend our day. And then we like to be home in 30 minutes. Like, that's a really comfortable time. During COVID, when we were all stuck at home, we wanted to get away, right? We're like, I got to get out of here. But if the commute or the trip is more than 30 minutes, it's kind of annoying. 45 minutes, an hour, more than an hour. Don't want to do that every day. And that has always, interestingly, been inherent. So when we had our feet, cities were about a mile and a half in diameter, because that was like 30 minutes by foot. When we had horses, they were like 3 miles in diameter. So if you look at like Walled Beijing or Old City Paris, they're like 3 mile cities. Trains came online and we saw like Chicago's of the world, they're 10 mile cities. And for the last 100 years, we've used cars, and cars give us 15 mile cities, like 30 miles an hour average gives us a 15 mile, 30 minute commute. So like Atlanta is a typical car city. What we're talking about here won't be day one, but over time, as this becomes a little more ubiquitous, your circle of economic activity is going to change to be 80 miles, right? So, you know, living in the Washington, D.C. area, it means you might actually live in Richmond and commute into the city. It means these 80-mile circles are like a grocery run. You know, your spouse may say, hey, can you run and grab some milk? I need you to go 80 miles away. And you'll, that's something you'll do a little more spontaneously, whereas today, that's a planned trip, you know, a month later. And so this is really the power that the U.S. is starting to compete in. And a lot of the globe has recognized how important this is. And so when you hear some of the politicians and some of the new leadership at FAA talk about how important the segment is, this is a bit of that. And I think this is also where I believe all of aviation starts to hit its stride, because as everybody wants that kind of movement and that kind of distance and that kind of life, it really lets us be something new in the country.
Yeah, that is really, really fascinating. I'd like you to tell us a little bit about the aircraft itself, because that's the key to this. We started with a very wide net of an awful lot of companies promising awful lot of things. It felt like the old very light jet days. And now we've boiled down, and it's a very, very, very short list at the moment. And the real credible list is leading here in the United States, Joby, backed by Toyota. Tell me about the aircraft.
Yeah. So look, Joben Bevert is our chairman, founder, and CEO, along with Paul Sciarra, who is the co-founder with Joben. They spent, you know, since 2009 developing motors and batteries and electronics. Battery density is not, as I mentioned earlier, it's not as good as jet fuel. Like the energy density in jet fuel is great, and we don't use it that efficiently. So if you look at what we do with a turbine, we're dumping a lot of heat out of the tail. We're pretty lax in how we use the bleed air. Aerodynamics are good, but they're really not as slick as they could be. We really had to be cautious in weight, in aerodynamics, and in energy usage. And so because we wanted to make the absolute most out of the energy density that we have. From the Joby perspective, I think that means that what you're seeing here is we actually tilt the propellers in flight. So they are both a part of our flight control as well as a part of how we propulse and go into vertical flight on the aircraft. So when we want to be moving fast on the wing, those propellers are all forward. When we want to be hovering, you'll see them all up in a beautiful thrust-borne flight mode. And they actually live in between. And when you're actually controlling the aircraft, they don't move together. They move as flight controls, right? So they will move through a fly-by-wire system to give you the aerodynamic effect you're looking for. And that is pretty exciting. You can kind of see this picture. We're semi-thrust-borne, and there's a fully thrust-borne hover right there. I think you also saw some pictures of our surfaces. So we do fly on the wing. You know, we are fully wing-borne in some parts of flight. We have, there you go, you can kind of see on the tail, triple rudder vaders. We have dual ailerons on the wing, and that is based in the architecture of traditional fly-by-wire, where you have a lot of redundancy in the fly-by-wire going to redundant surfaces. And so you kind of think through high levels of reliability, high levels of redundancy. And then as a pilot, actually some of the pilot skills are really exciting to talk about here. The way we fly this, you know, we wouldn't expect you to as a pilot, be flipping a lot of levers to tip the motors. We wouldn't expect you to be reading up and down the RPM independently. You're not going to be able to do that very well. So fly-by-wire does that job. And what the pilot does is the pilot gives intent about how fast and what direction would I like to go. This is not something that we invented. So there's a flight methodology called unified flight controls. It was actually developed after the Harrier program. There was a 30-year effort, super nerdy. The VAAC Harrier program, V-A-A-C Harrier program, was intended to develop what is the right way to control VTOL aircraft. And they came up with something called unified flight control. And that means that one hand controls speed or forward back, and one hand controls up, down, left, right. And unlike in a Harrier where those functions switch hands depending on how fast you're moving, in a modern VTOL, it's always the same. So this is how the F-35B flies. It's the flight control methodology in the F-35B. It lets the warfighter concentrate on things other than the machine-human interface, right? The pilot is saying, how fast and where do I want to go? Well, I've got a lot of other things going on. And in the Joby, it's the same way. So we keep you in a safe envelope. We let you say, how fast and what direction do you want to be going right now? And you know, do I want to be in a hover? Do I want to be on the wing? At what speed? If I let go, the aircraft will keep itself safe. And even in a hover, you know, hands off, stays in a hover. That is not something I see in the helicopters I fly. And so you can imagine that the burden on the pilot is lowered. And that lets you do other things with your bandwidth, with your mental bandwidth. You get to pay attention to safety planning. Do you get to pay attention to kind of those higher minded things that you learn over time as a pilot? Let's make sure navigation's good. How's the weather doing? What's my energy status? And really focus on some exciting things in that way. Now, I think you'll have two reactions as you learn this. You'll kind of say, like, wait a second, I like my tail dragger skills. Well, so do I. And they're not going anywhere. It's like tail draggers will be here and we will all be able to prove how great of pilots we are without ground looping. But, you know, it's also pretty fun to not have to take a tail dragger everywhere you go. When you're looking on long cross country, it's nice to be up and away in an easy way. And so these products are built to really open some new opportunities in novelly safe, exciting ways.
I think that's really fascinating because, as you've mentioned as a theme all the way along, is that this supports regular aviation. I mean, to do this, especially in a way that provides confidence for the flying public as this expands, it's still a pilot. It's still someone that you think of, even if this airplane does not fly with those skills, of a tail dragger. It still flies with an understanding of airspace and emergencies and responsibility and terrain and all and traffic and all the other things that really matter about having someone at the controls. And so I feel like it does support all this, and yet most people don't necessarily think of it that way. When I was with you out at MDAA, though, I got to get in it and actually see how this really works. And it's quite fascinating in how these, I guess, how simple, in a way, the controls are. What are your thoughts on how you're going to bring a pilot population into the aircraft?
Well, so I want to make a quick shout out, by the way, to Microsoft Flight Sim. So we were included this last year, so you can actually jump in and like fly that product and see what you're talking about, even at home. But those who are in the DC area or in California area, you should send a quick note to us. We'd love to kind of show you special pilots like how to do this and what it's like. The alternative is to jump in an F-35B, and that's probably much harder. So we'd love to show you the Joby way. So I think that we are really excited about part of the SFAR that talks about transition training. And so existing airplane pilots, existing helicopter pilots can take a kind of a condensed type rating with Joby or with other manufacturers, and then be given the category and class rating as they kind of build that proficiency in the aircraft, and will then be able to fly on the 135, for example, the Joby 135 commercial operation. The skills themselves are pretty apparent, and I'll be frank, I really am serious. Like, if folks send me a note and drop by and in the DC area, I would love to catch up. If we have a crazy response, I'll try to make it happen the best we can, but we do really love folks to come by and check it out. I will tell you, the experience is for non-pilots, within 2 or 3 minutes, they're doing vertical takeoffs, they're flying around the pattern, they're landing again vertically. Very simple, very straightforward. The folks that have the hardest time is actually the same cadre of folks who had difficulty in Unified and in traditional rotorcraft pilots, because we're used to the cyclic and collective. But to be frank, like transitioning from fixed wing to helicopter, you really have to be thinking every time you're switching if you've been spending a lot of time in the other, because the skills are different. So the rotary pilots tend to kind of use this hand for a cyclic for a minute until they remember, oh, no, that's not what I'm doing. And so we do look for like a recency in fixed wing time for folks that are going to transition through the course. And that works pretty well. But it's a really exciting time to be a pilot as well as an engineer. So I alluded to the idea of like how exciting it is to be an engineer right now. Well, look, pilots get to fly everything that's been invented so far and a brand new range of new aircraft coming online. It is going to be wild and exciting the next 5 years or so. Imagine a commercial pilot job where you can be home every single night, where you're flying around your community, you're moving people around that you know relatively well. That's pretty cool. And that is going to be a pretty amazing occupation here shortly.
Wow. And to help me clarify, what is it certified under in particular, and then what is the category and class?
Yeah, so the FAA, what they did is that Part 23 set of rules I alluded to, they had headed on a path of utilizing that set of rules, but then kind of made a change where they decided to call these things powered lift aircraft. So much like an Osprey, they call it a powered lift. Now, to be frank, the powered lift rules began as a much more rotorcraft-based set of rules where it included cyclic and collective and more traditional controls and more traditional rotorcraft-like flying. But the FAA has found a way to kind of right-size a special path, an SFAR, a special certification. So we're being certified a powered lift, a special powered lift aircraft, and pilots will be given or will get a powered lift rating as they train in these aircraft. With just like you can kind of do an add-on for airplane or an add-on for helicopter, you can do like an add-on powered lift, which is actually going to be abbreviated through that SFAR. So a really efficient path to get pilots the qualifications they need. It will be a type rating for these initial products because the flight control methodology is so different from what the very simple flight control methodology we've created is quite different than what you'll see in like a 609, for example, or like in a traditional Osprey. And so you'll get a type rating in all these aircraft to make sure that you're well-trained in the vehicle you're gonna fly. Over time, I'd anticipate FAA, there's a 10-year horizon where they're going to review these rules. So I'd anticipate at that point, once things are kind of steady state, they probably will come up with something more akin to like single engine, multi-engine ratings that let you move from vehicle to vehicle, because there's really some simplicity in the vehicles.
What about air traffic? When you think about, we talked a little bit about, the infrastructure on the ground and that you're saying existing capacity for that is somewhat helped by the noise issue, and that'll expand for the existing things, and then I assume public demand will create more sites. But what about ATC handling all of it?
So I often think about my cross-country flights in the US. So when you're kind of on a cross-country flight, it is pretty boring. You're kind of just cruising along for hours on end, and the only thing you're really doing is changing frequencies. You're not really seeing much traffic in the air, right? I mean, that is, the airspace is large. The sky is big. Where it's not big, where it's tight and concise, is right at those large airports, right? Everyone trying to get onto that final, like close final, on a big airport, big runway, is where it's congested. And guess what? We don't need to land there. We can land in the non-movement areas. We can land in other designated areas around those airports to stay out of the flow of those like big iron aircraft having to get into the really critical pavement. And so done correctly, there is a ton of capacity in the system.
Does that mean sort of uncontrolled, if you don't mind, when you think about that, meaning like your VFR and you're looking at a heliport example or VTOL port in this case, and you're basically everybody's waiting for their turn, or how does that work?
I think it's actually a huge range across the spectrum. So absolutely within controlled airspace. So within Class B, you'll see these activities and operations. You'll see them at uncontrolled airports as well. Heliports, you'll probably see some very high density heliports with collaboration and control happening over time. In the early days, I think we're going to be heavily capacity limited. The US has, for the aircraft, I mean, you know, how fast they can be produced. The US has over 5,000 public use airports. When you add heliports onto that, there's over like 10,000 pieces of infrastructure. That's a lot. And so when you kind of think through, you know, what's gonna be the pinch point, by the time the airspace or the infrastructure is the pinch point, we're talking wild levels of success. So I think the belief is that you'll kind of see a steady progression and steady growth and lots of learning in the first five years. And then the real issue we all should think through is how do we, as an entire system, think through the future of air traffic? I think we want to think through, like, how does the heavy iron get more efficient in the IFR system? How does the, you know, we're going to be adding drones. We've got commercial space. We've got this new segment. And trying to really efficiently move aircraft in the IFR system is something that really needs to be solved. I think every one of us, when we sit down, kind of knows technology can do it. But the complexity of that challenge, like, how do you integrate everyone at once? How do you upgrade all the technology? We just went through that with ADS-B, and it was you know, a slog. That is something that needs to really be thought through in the next decade to make sure that the U.S. can continue to lead aerospace for the next 100 years. I think this early step of making sure that these aircraft are certified, ready, integrated into the airspace is a huge move forward to making sure that we maintain leadership as the U.S. But then the next question becomes, how do you really start to make sure that the economy of the future, that the goods and services people want through drone deliveries, that the transportation people are going to come to really hope for on a day-to-day basis can exist? And that's really important work that we need to think through. And I think we're starting to see people pay really close attention to where the airspace needs to evolve and air traffic system needs to evolve over time. So I think we'll all be part of that solution.
Yeah. Well, so tell us a little bit about where Joby actually is now in your timeline and what we all should expect from the future that we're talking about.
So the, you know, bringing these aircraft into being, the first critical step is FAA certification of the design. And so we have been working through that. Officially, we applied for certification with the FAA in 2018. Originally, we began working with FAA actually in like late 2015, early 2016. And so we've been doing this for years. We've moved through FAA essentially has five stages of certification. So the first is like, what are the rules that apply? So that became clear. Here's the rules that apply to the Joby vehicle, locked in place, signed off. Second is, what standards are going to use? Like, how are you going to show that you met those rules substantially and safely? So those are, you know, that's stage two. What standards will you use? And you come to agreement with FAA on every rule. Every standard is going to be used for every finding. And then the next piece is the certification plan. So stage three is, show me broadly, how are you going to certify all the systems and show that you met all these rules and show that you used all these standards that you said? And then across all of your vehicle and systems and across structures and across the flight testing, you kind of go through all the certification pieces with your certification plans, and that's stage three. Stage four is doing it. So where is your testing that lines up? Each of those certification plans has a bunch of tests that need to happen. Ground test, bench test, analysis, flight test. And so into the testing is stage four. That's where we are today. So stage one, two, and three are complete. Stage four, into the testing. We've now given the FAA about half of our test plans to be signed off, and the FAA signed off over a third of them. So I think 50 some percent turned over to FAA, 30 some percent, 37 maybe, is now signed off by FAA. So we're seeing those sets of bars fill up right now, right, to get that stage four closed. And stage five is finishing those tests and turning over the reports. And so we're in that stage. So stage four and five are kind of completing. So we're coming to final agreement on all the test plans that need to happen and starting to execute those tests. What's interesting about that is you're moving from a world of like a lot of ambiguity. What rules should apply to these crazy vehicles, right? That's known. What standards could you possibly use to do this right? And that's known. How are you going to certify this? What is the broad scope of the certification plan known? What are the very specific tests? It really starts to look much more like traditional aviation when you get into like the tests you're doing, structural tests, earth and lightning tests, bird strike tests. So all the traditional tests, and then doing the tests. like very turn the crank work. Not easy. A lot of bandwidth goes into that. It's a lot of time to do, a lot of things to be tested, but that's where we are. And so we are really excited to be in this final sprint to kind of bring these aircraft across the line into certification. In parallel to that, we stood up our Part 135 air carrier certificate a couple years back. And the thinking was that there's a lot of things that happen when you stand up a new air carrier certificate. Your pilots have to get familiar, or the FAA has to be familiar with your pilots and the leadership of that organization. Your mechanics have to know the procedures and be familiar, and you have to build a set of manuals. And we didn't want to do that after. So, right. Because we wanted to make sure that we could do this all together as soon as we certified. So that 135 is in place. And it's operating a Cirrus to make sure that we have all the people and the procedures and manuals approved for that. But when we built that 135, we did it in a way eyes wide open to the future product, right? So the FAA didn't think, hey, this is just a Cirrus forever. Very clearly knew the product we were all trying to get to, then the thing right. The FAA was really going to oversee. So the amazing folks at our I don't think we call it a FISDO anymore, but the amazing folks locally from FAA, they were on board and excited about building a manual set that could be used in those ways. And so that's ready to go. We have started to announce partnerships with Delta, partnerships with Toyota for manufacturing. I mentioned the Uber partnership. Overseas, we have partners with ANA Airlines. We have a partnership we just announced with Virgin Atlantic, which is super exciting. So we've been cautious not to get folks too overly excited about that part of the world, like the service that's coming and what it's going to look like. But the noise you're hearing from us is that it's time. So it's time for that part of the world to come alive, because we're in the final bit of the sprint. So, you know, if you look at New York City, they've dedicated their heliports to this kind of activity, making sure they're ready for it. If you look at what's happening in California and LA, like you're hearing these conversations. Orlando has talked a lot about it in the Miami area. Dallas just had a large event at Verticon, and there was a lot of talk about what's exciting down there. So the country's coming alive around the world. There's a competition for the space. Everyone wants to be first. And so we are in that final sprint to bring this into reality.
Wow. And what about the sort of last piece of the puzzle, which is the production certificate? You certainly mentioned the operation side and the certification of that, but there are plenty of companies that buy a type certificate that's existed for a while, and it takes a long time to be able to produce.
Yeah, Jeff, you are a smart, smart man. The PC, the production certificate, is a hard thing. One of the things we've done is we are a super vertical company. We build all of our batteries, our motors, our electronics. We build our own software. We build the airframes. There's very little we don't make. And we have been doing that through a production line that's going to be put onto the PC around the same time as the type certification. And that is not easy. So it's a big organization pulling through all the quality and oversight off of the production line. Today, our production line's in Marina, California. And that production line is sized to get to the size of about 25 aircraft a year. We also announced plans to do a larger production site in Dayton, Ohio. And so what you'll see is that our initial production site, we call it the pilot production site. That can be a little confusing because we're not making pilots there, but we're building aircraft there. So the smaller production site at home in California will always be there to make sure that we have the PC in place and maintained, and it'll have a lot of large equipment, but in small numbers, so we can mass produce that in all over the world, right? And so Dayton will be an example of that. We will take all of that equipment proven, you know, in Marina and set it up in lines in Dayton, Ohio, so we can produce those aircraft. And so that is the knob that's being turned now. And you know, you can really understand how substantial and important that is to turn that knob appropriately. As you get closer and closer to that type certification and commercial ops, you need a ramp because you need aircraft. But if you do that too soon, you can spend the resources you have too quickly. And so as we mature as companies, you're gonna see what's happening at Joby now, where we're really turning those corners and really starting to bring this stuff into reality. And those production lines are humming and getting ready for PC.
Fascinating. So how can people find out more about Joby Aircraft Aviation, and then also even if they're interested in participating or joining, as you mentioned?
Yeah, so we have a website, joby.aero or jobyaviation.com. And we have a whole lot of jobs listed. We feel very fortunate to have passionate, you know, the passion in aviation is amazing. And we have a lot of really passionate aviation loving folks at Joby. Our team is nearly 2,000 folks at this point.
Wow.
And we are looking for all kinds of amazing new folks to keep joining. We're going to need folks for more production. We're going to need more engineers. We need more amazing pilots to join the ranks. And mechanics, as you mentioned, like, gosh, the mechanics, it's a really exciting path, by the way, as an aside here. When we think through the job of being a mechanic in this coming world, it's a whole new range of skills and activities, and really fun to challenge yourself and learn that new skill. So, incredibly important to
Yeah.
bring some new mechanics into the space too.
It's fascinating to me. One of the things that kind of came full circle just this week, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that we have a partnership with the FAA and a complete FAA learning center in social flight, and tons of courses there, including for mechanics. And we added, I think, 10 courses just over the last week. And one of them that really surprised me is that there was a dedicated FAA course now for mechanics on electric aircraft and urban air mobility aircraft, and starting to teach the safety aspects of working on them, the intricacies of working on them. Aircraft that very few of, except for maybe some pipistrel training aircraft, exist today, but the FAA is already training and giving credit to mechanics for that. I found that fascinating.
It is awesome, and it's really exciting to kind of think through, you know, high voltage safety, to think through, you know, a lot of the aircraft that we're looking at have buses that are really high speed data buses, a lot of solid state equipment, the background in software, the cybersecurity backbone that needs to exist on these aircraft and be maintained, some really cool skill sets that honestly traditional mechanics love to learn about and engage in, and it's pretty natural. And then a whole new generation of folks that are excited to get engaged. So it is exciting. I feel this crazy idea I had, you know, this crazy lay in bed, should I do this or not? Like, I'm really glad I did. And I think, like, everyone out there doing that tonight, like, you should do it. Jump on board. Like, let's get going.
You made a very, very good choice. All right, Greg, we have reached the time of our show that we like to do something called Social Flight's Fast Five. Are you up for that?
I'm up. Let's see what happens.
All right, Greg Bowles of Joby Aviation. This is your Social Flight's Fast Five. Five questions just to let people get to know you a little bit better. And I'm going to start with question number one, which is, you have had this wonderful, rich history of flying both fixed wing and rotorcraft and all the way up to the Joby aircraft that we've been talking about here. Out of all those, is there one that's kind of closest to your heart that from your past that kind of speaks to you?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll answer as fast as I can. So in my memory, I think of the original Cessna 150 sitting on the floor with my legs straight out, up to like some more modern aircraft. I think of all those. My favorite was, I had the fortune to be part of a build of a Glassair Sportsman, in tail dragger configuration, and that is probably the most fun airplane to fly around. A close second is probably flying in the grass and in various rotorcraft. That's a pretty fun thing to do too with the doors off. But I'm going to say the Glassair Sportsman is pretty awesome. As long as it's in tail dragger configuration.
As long as it's in tail dragger, I love that. That's awesome. All right. Question number two, out of that flying, was there any specifically kind of scary or impactful moment that you feel that you learned something from that you carry with you to this day?
Yeah, so I think that you know, one time I had engine trouble in a Cirrus, in the IFR system, with like a young intern on board, and had to make kind of a precautionary landing slash emergency landing at a large airport. And fortunately, kind of, you know, year after year of always saying like, "What's next? Where are you?" worked out well. And I think that, never something you love to be in, is having to get down like one way trip. I think it reinforced the idea, don't get lazy. Like, let's always watch our iPads. Let's always look around for what's next and where are we going if we lose an engine on a single. So I think that's probably it.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, question number three. If you could go back in time to some wonderful moment of aviation, just to re-experience it, not to change anything, just to transport yourself and be back there for 15 minutes or so, what moment comes to mind?
So I think having, grandfather in World War II, and some of the stories, obviously harrowing, obviously amazingly brave generation of folks, but the opportunity to really do some high risk but well conceived things with people who want to, the best and brightest who are gonna help you succeed. I would love to be a pilot in World War II. That would have been amazing. Mm. Even a fighter, that would have been probably the best.
Very cool. All right, question number four. If you could go back in time and give some advice to your younger self in your teens or your 20s, what do you think you might say?
You know, I was given really good advice. So I had an uncle who flew for the airlines, and no offense to the airlines, he flew for US Air. And when I was in high school, I said, I'm gonna be an airline pilot. And he pulled me aside and he said, listen, like, I don't love flying anymore. I used to love flying. Now it's not so much love. He's like, do something else and you should be an engineer and then fly less often as your job. And I treasure that recommendation. And so I think I maybe rebounded a little too far. So I became an engineer and a policy guy, and I don't get to fly as often as I wish. So I think if I could talk to myself, I would say, like, listen to that advice, but take a grain of salt. Like, stay a little bit more on the controls and a little bit out of the policy and engineering. There's probably a really exciting walk there where you get to fly a lot more than I often get to.
That makes a lot of sense, but I think you wound up in a good place regardless. Okay, our last question, question number five. If you could choose anyone alive or no longer with us from history, anywhere at all, anyone to spend an evening with, who might that be?
I think I would want to spend an evening with John Glenn. I think that he lived a wild life. It included obviously the space work, it included amazing times in aviation, but also in politics and navigating the life as a senator. And I think looking at where we stand as a country, some of that, the formative years and the really exciting times where we did bold things as a country and shaped foundations at a wild time, like the jet age. I'd love to hear that firsthand through somebody like John Glenn, and then try to distill those thoughts into what we need to be doing as a country right now to make sure that we succeed where we are.
That makes so much sense. I would love to join you for that evening. Well, Greg, we've come to the end of our hour. I have truly treasured it, and thank you so much. I hope that as things progress over at Joby, that perhaps you'll come back on in the future with some more news and updates and another opportunity to spend a little bit of time together.
Yeah, if you said the time might fly. Thank you so much. It did. I am excited to catch up again, and hopefully we have you watching an aircraft and maybe flying one of our aircraft here shortly.
You got it, and I look forward to seeing you. You will have a big display, as I understand it, at AirVenture this year, and I certainly expect that we'll spend some time together there.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to it. I'll see you all soon. Right. Thank you.
Have a wonderful evening.
Good night.
And thank you so much for taking time out of your evening to join us here on Social Flight Live. We will be off next week, but there's going to be content coming out if you look at our YouTube channel, because it is sun and fun time. So I'll be down there reporting with some of the friends and colleagues and other folks. And if you happen to be going to the show, please be sure to try to track me down somewhere. If you go to any of the booths that are here on this board, thank them for supporting Social Flight, please. And you can ask them where I am, because chances are I'll be hanging out with them and visiting many, many times. And I look forward to meeting you all in person for anyone who's going to be down there. And I might have some swag to give away as well. In addition to that, then following Sun and Fun, we are back on April 8th at 8 p.m. Eastern time. That's Tuesday, April 8th, with our Cockpit to Cowl show. Myself and Brian Schiff will be talking about improving your landings and maintenance of your landing gear. So that's Cockpit to Cowl, cockpit, the number 2 and the word cowl. It's a separate show to register for. Again, just go to cockpittocowl.com. And then we're back here at Social Flight Live on Tuesday, April 15th, with Juan Brown of Blanco Lorio. The channel will be talking about aircraft and accident analysis. He does such a wonderful job. We're going to talk about responsible reporting and analysis of aviation accidents, which I think is really, really important. And I truly admire the very factual and really informed way that he approaches everything. So that's Juan Brown of the Blanco Lorio channel. If you see that on YouTube, where he's going to be here April 15th. Until next time, I'm Jeff Simon for Social Flight, and I wish you all blue skies.